Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Psychic Teachers. I'm your host, Deb Bowen.
And I'm Samantha Fay.
We are here and we are delighted and honored that you have joined us tonight. And we are so excited, folks. We have Ryan Singer with us tonight as our guest. And I have to tell you, having Ryan with us is just such a great thing. So we're so excited about what this next hour is going to bring. So welcome, everybody, for whenever you are listening to this show. We're happy to have you with us. We're not going to do our normal opening with crystals and animals and meditations tonight. We're going to skip that, so that gives us plenty of time to talk with Ryan. So sit back and relax and enjoy your evening. Ryan, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm real excited.
Good.
This will be fun.
Oh, good.
For those
glad
of you
you're here.
Who aren't familiar with Ryan's work, he is a stand-up comedian. He has 3 full-length albums. He was mentioned in Rolling Stone magazine as a comic who should be big. He is a returning actor in IFC's Marin and the creator and host of a wonderful podcast I really hope you guys check out if you haven't already, called Me and Paranormal You. So he's just big in the world of comedy, and he's big in the world of paranormal. And what I really enjoy about your work, Ryan, is the way you look at all sides of beliefs, and you never come at it with any judgment. Like just recently on your show, you did the left-hand path, and then you followed it up with the right-hand path. So I just love the way you approach all things spiritual with such a balanced, non-judgmental mind.
Oh, well, thank you. I mean, it's a lot of fun, like, diving in and, you know, kind of exploring, especially since I started the podcast. I mean, it's really opened my mind to a lot of other things. I mean, I was always a pretty open mind to begin with, at least, you know, according to some people who were more locked into, you know, not even considering some of these things that are considered outside the normal or paranormal, if you will. But, yeah, and I think it's important, too, to... You know, I think the world is ready for, you know, to understand that people who have these alternative beliefs, who believe in, you know, clairvoyance and all this other stuff and aliens and ghosts, like, these people also have a sense of humor. And the world, I know the entertainment industry, at least being on in that world, when I've talked to people who are decision makers about television programs and stuff like that, they're like, these people don't want humor. They want information. And I was like, no, these people also have a sense of humor. And it's like there was this weird misconception, and I think it's starting to melt away a little bit because of other podcasts that are also, you know, kind of have a comedic tilt to them dealing with the subject. But it's interesting to think that, like, these people, these decision makers, thought that people who believe in paranormal stuff or are outside the normal don't have a sense of humor. And it's always been kind of a point of frustration for me. So I'm kind of glad that that's kind of melting away, you know, trying to chip away at that.
I think that's great to make it approachable for everyone. Go ahead, Deb.
Absolutely. I think that's true. Samantha and I get a lot of comments that the exchange between the two of us on our show is often humorous, and sometimes we don't mean to be funny, but folks take us that way, and that's okay. You know, that's great. We had a great comment on our Facebook page about you being on the show tonight, and I was so happy. It said, oh, wow, my 2 favorite podcasts come together at last. And I thought,
oh wow.
How about that?
That's great. Well, in a moment of synchronicity, last night, I'm home in Los Angeles, and I was doing a show in Echo Park at, like, you know, on the back patio of, like, a bookstore. It's, like, a really neat, fun little show. And I ran into an old a friend of mine who's a comedian. I didn't know she had moved to Los Angeles. And I hadn't seen her in a while. And she starts talking about, like, oh, my God, I listened to your podcast. And then I listened to this other podcast, and it's really helping me kind of open up and discover my psychic abilities. And I was like, wait one second. Are you talking about – and she goes, what? And I go, are you talking about Psychic Teachers? And she goes, oh, my God, how'd you know that? I was like, because I'm talking to them tomorrow. So it's like this conversation was supposed to be happening.
That's wonderful.
Ryan, when I reached out to you, one of the things that I think people like your friend who are opening up to their intuition and realizing – oh my God, I think I have this intuitive ability. One thing they struggle with is kind of the religion that they were indoctrinated with. And one thing that drew me to your podcast was listening to your interview on, you know, WTF with Mark Maron about how you were raised in this wonderful family of, like, real Catholics, you know, which you don't see a lot anymore. And I have a very similar upbringing. And I just would love for you to talk about what it was like being raised with, because you talk in that interview about how you wanted to be a priest and you memorized the Mass. And I just think it's so cool that now, you know, you're in this spiritual realm. So if you could just talk a little about that process of, you know, Catholic boy who wants to be a priest to, you know, co-host of, you know, one of the top 10 spiritual podcasts.
Well, it was, you know, I mean, first of all, I should say that, like, both sides of my family, very loving and very large, kind of like Irish, German, Catholic, you know, big families, lots of aunts and uncles, and like a very loving environment, but also very, you know, reading the Bible before dinner, reading it after dinner, when all the family is together. Like in my person, like my mom and dad home, we didn't really do that, but when we were with the grandparents and stuff, that happened a lot. And so it was, you know, Catholic school, so I was in church a lot, and, you know, always, and I was an altar boy, so I was always like helping out, doing things, I was involved in the church, and you know, and I, you know, whether or not it still, I'm sure there's some kind of thread, continual thread. I would be lying if I didn't say, you know, there was some ego that, you know, is involved in all of it, even as a kid, thinking that I was special. And, you know, not only did I want to be a priest, I kind of had this idea that I was going to be like the most important priest. Like, like it was, you know, it's looking back, I'm like, oh man, even at like 9 years old, I was kind of an egomaniac and wanted to be performing. Because my mom told me a story. My brother and I, who's slightly older than me, we shared a room our whole lives. And she said one time she was walking by our room and she heard Chad and I talking. It's my brother's name. And I asked him, I was like, what do you want to be when you grow up? And he's like, I want to be like an Air Force pilot or something. And he goes, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I said, well, when I grow up, I want to be a priest. And he goes, a priest? Why would you want to do that? And I said, and she says, and I quote, I just see myself up there on that stage, and I tell everybody, Mass is ended, go in peace to love and serve the Lord, and they all listen to me. And I was like, oh. So it's like, you know, I was just a kid who wanted a captive audience, because as a comedian, you have a, you know, somewhat captive audience, and it's a solo performance, but what better audience to have than, you know, one that thinks their eternal salvation rests on paying attention to you. So, to me, that's like, you can't have a better audience, you know. But I don't know, as I got older, I just kind of, you know, I had, you know, what they call crises of faith or whatever the right word is. And I would fluctuate in and out of, you know, believing. And then, I don't know, in my early 20s, I really had kind of a crazy, I'd started doing stand-up comedy briefly, kind of. And then I had a major kind of religious meltdown where I thought stand-up comedy is the most selfish profession in the entire world. That means I'm going to hell. I mean, I was like that. I was the epitome of the selfish sinner kind of guy. Right. And so I really kind of freaked out, had some, you know, a bad few years there where, you know, I thought the world was ending. I do have a habit of taking things too far from time to time in my life. You know, an issue with boundaries, I suppose. So when I locked into that, it kind of, sorry about that. I think,
it's all right.
I thought I muted my phone, but it was, you know, so I just kind of went too far with it and like went to the extreme of it and, you know, which isn't a healthy thing to do. And all that, you know, Catholic guilt that was kind of indoctrinated into me, you know, not necessarily on purpose by my family, but it happened. Really just kind of exploded and manifested itself in real negative ways. So, but then it wasn't until I had a moment of, like a real moment of like awakening in my mid-20s because it was actually my late 20s, mm-hmm. because my grandma, I had this one grandma who was, you know, the epitome of the purest kind of Catholic you can be. And she was a living saint. I mean, there was nothing this woman, I mean, if there is a heaven, she's right at the front of the line, you know? And we had this moment when I was a kid where she, like, had this picture that she showed me, because I used to spend, like, the summers out on her farm with my grandpa, working, and we would go to Mass, like, almost every day, and they had this, like, cafeteria where they would do food afterwards, and someone took a photo. This is, you know, back in the 80s, so they developed a photo, and the Virgin Mary was floating in the photo.
Whoa, was she, like, full size?
No, she was, like, torso. It was, like, torso to top of the head, right? And I remember her showing that to me, like, because I remember her handing it to me in her kitchen, and she says, look who was at lunch with us last week. And I look at it, I was like, what? And she goes, that's the Virgin Mary. And I was like, oh, my God. I'm like, so no matter how far away I got away from the church, I stopped going to church, you know, in my early 20s, late teens. You know, I was, you know, probably drinking too much, doing drugs, things like that. I was, you know, I wasn't Catholic by any stretch of the means in practice. But in the back of my mind, I always had this moment like, well, no matter how dark it ever gets or how far away I ever stray from the Lord, I'll have that moment where I have evidence. They say seeing is believing, and I saw.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then I remember it was in my late 20s. I was over there hanging out with her, and, you know, this was, you know, maybe a couple years before she died. So she was probably like her late 70s, early 80s. And I said, and I brought that up because she would always ask me, are you going to church? And I felt bad because I'd always kind of have to, I always kind of avoided the question or slightly lied to her because I knew it would kind of break her heart if she knew I wasn't doing it. And I was like, you know what, Grandma? You know what? The one thing that always keeps me going back and knowing that there's God. And she's like, what's that? And I go, remember that time when we had that photo, the photo of the Virgin Mary? Like, talk about a miracle, you know, a physical evidence of a miracle. I mean, what else do you need? That's like such a profound moment in a person's life. And she just looks at me and she's like, what are you talking about? And I was like, that photo you showed me, I was like 9 years old, of the Virgin Mary hanging out with us. And she goes, oh, I don't remember that. And I was just like, and I remember, like, I'll never forget where I was sitting and just looking at her. She was sitting in this, like, lazy boy chair, and I just felt like the last bastions of, like, the Catholic grip evaporate from my pores. Where I was just like,
did you find that sad or freeing?
Probably a combination of both, because regardless of whether or not it was, you know, unhealthy to, like, have that kind of fear and stuff, it was still comforting because it was so,
right.
I was so used to it, which I think, you know, a lot of people probably experience even when something isn't great for you, at least it's, you know, at least it's, you know,
familiar.
What you expect. And you, yeah, it's familiar. That's the word. And so it was kind of a combination of freeing and sad. But, I mean, none of that stuff I don't think ever truly leaves. I mean, I don't know how you feel about it, but I feel like, because I don't remember learning about hell. So, and I don't think I can understate how, like, important that is in, like, the development of my psyche and, like, the way I think, because, like, to me, that's like, well, what's real? Oh, well, if it's real, it's like you don't even have to learn it because it's just there. So it's like it's always been there. So, like, to me, that was, I tried to work through that ever since that moment. And, you know, every once in a while, the leaves, the wind will blow and the leaves will rustle just in the right way. And maybe there's some gray clouds in the sky at, like, twilight. And I'll be like, oh, no, this is it. You know what I mean? I'll have that moment like, oh, this is the apocalypse. This is the, okay, the earth's going to open, the sky's going to open, and the battle will begin. So I'm not going to act like that doesn't happen to me every, you know, once in a while under the right conditions where I'll get a weird feeling about something like that. But it's, you know, I don't know.
Right, I have to tell you, I remember when Deb and I were first really starting out doing this work for real, she and I were both college teachers, so for us to start doing readings, you know, was a real risk to our career.
Oh, yeah.
And we would stay up late talking, like, are we really going to do this? Are we doing this? I don't know. And so, of course, I have the Catholic Bible, the St. Joseph version, and on the last line of the Bible, the Book of Revelations, the very last line says, and all the whores, dogs, and fortune tellers will be thrown into the pits of hell.
Yeah, right.
Do you remember,
oh,
Deb? And I was reading that.
Oh, I do remember. And Ryan, I grew up a Protestant and am now a practicing pagan. And when Samantha read that to me, I said, you know, let me go get the Protestant Bible and let's compare notes here. And fortunately, my Bible didn't have that last line, so we went with that instead.
Yeah.
You know?
It is interesting to think about, like, these, all the weight that is ascribed to things that other people have written, whether or not they realize they would become that important or not later, you know,
oh,
hundreds
absolutely.
Of years later, you know, or
yeah.
thousands of years later.
Oh,
so
I know. Like when
is,
Paul told all the women to sit down and shut up, like according to the historical documents, he was talking about these three gossipy ladies in the back of one church. You know, but the whole religion has used it as a reason to keep women down and out.
It's tough to, but once you, well, hopefully everyone reaches that point in their life where they kind of, you know, start independently critically thinking,
mm-hmm.
and it's not easy to take responsibility to do that. It's, you know, it's like the opposite of just kind of being, it's not lazy to not do it necessarily, but, you know, because different people have different situations, but to actively pursue knowledge is, it's like a vocation almost, is that what they'd call it. And I remember I was so into being a priest as a kid that they actually had the priest come over to the house one Saturday afternoon and sit down and talk to me about what a vocation is and like start laying out like all the things that it means to do to be a priest. And, you know, I just remember he just kept talking about, if this is your calling, if this is your vocation, you know it. There's no doubt in your mind about it. And at the time I was running around calling myself the peacemaker. You know, I was like so into like, obviously it turned out that I was not going to be doing that later in life as we sit here today. But I think it's a similar kind of thing when you take responsibility for trying to learn. I think you only become thirstier and thirstier for that knowledge once you learn. Like, I'm really into like the ancient esoteric knowledge quest right now. It's also fascinating to me, and like to think that like a couple of years ago I didn't even really know about any of this stuff, and there's so much stuff out there, and
it's
really redefining the way I think
about
it.
The more you learn, the more there is to learn.
Oh, it's
yeah.
like peeling away layers and layers and layers of an unending onion. There's so much.
Yeah. I want to go back to something you said. Sorry, Deb, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and I don't know about you, Ryan, but I find so much connection among various esoteric beliefs as I research them. And that's, for me, a part of the fascination. I don't know about for you.
Oh, yeah. They're kind of, it's like, I kind of see it as this like beautiful rope that's all twined together with
mm-hmm.
all these different, you know, these different like styles and, you know, and different fabrics. And they all kind of combine into this one thing to, you know, to build something that's like stronger and actually can hold weight.
Yeah, that's a beautiful analogy. Thank you.
Yeah,
Samantha,
really,
I didn't mean to interrupt. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, when you said that part of your spiritual crisis was initiated by you believing that your chosen profession of comedian was selfish, I just want to go back to that because I am like a comedian, like I've read all the comedians' biographies. Like, I'm fascinated by comedians. I'm fascinated by anybody who can stand up on stage and make people laugh. And I think comedians are healers. Like, I think that you are, you know, Ernest Hemingway said, it's really easy to write. All you have to do is sit down and cut open a vein. And I kind of feel the same way about comedians. Like, to get up on stage and say, I am going to raise the energetic vibration in this room, I am going to make you all laugh, and I'm going to make you all leave this room feeling better than you did when you came in. Like, I don't think there's anything selfish about that. Do you still look at it that way, or have you shifted that view of yourself?
I've definitely shifted that view since then. There was a moment in my life where, you know, I had given up, you know, after when the crisis really finally came to a head. I mean, the writing was on the wall that I was kind of living a lie because I'd started waiting tables at a comedy club even during this time. So all I would do is go to work, and then I would go home, and I would just be in my room and kind of read the Bible. I was reading all the Left Behind series books. Like, they couldn't write them fast enough. I think I read, like, the first 8 or 9, and that's when I stopped. And that's when I kind of finally broke out of this before they even finished the series. But and I was like, oh, it's true, it's true. The book of Revelations are unfolding before us. Oh, my God. So I'd become, like, a prisoner to this belief system. Benefiting or making my life better, it had imprisoned me. And like, when I, the only way I could really wrap my brain around like making that choice to leave was one day I was like, you know, God should be like a puppy, you know, it should, you know, contribute to the joy of my life. It shouldn't make me a prisoner to it. You know, like, you don't need to have a puppy if you can no longer live the rest of your life because you have to take care of this puppy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're supposed to nurture and take care of that puppy, but it shouldn't now be your master in that kind of way. So, and then I kind of just broke free. And then slowly but surely, you know, after a few years, I got back into stand-up comedy through improv. And then I had the moment with my grandma where she didn't remember the thing. And then boom, that's when the floodgates really opened. And I don't know if I was, I would definitely say in that period I was not kind of healing as much as I was, you know, kind of trying to purge a lot of pent-up anger and, you know, regret and sadness about religion. A lot of my early material when I first started out was very anti-religious, anti-God, very dark, very vulgar. And, you know, thank goodness Twitter wasn't around back then, you know, because I probably wouldn't have a career now. Because of all the horrible things I probably would have put out into the universe. But, and then I, you know, one day decided that like, or figured out or realized that I was funnier when I was happier. And that was about 2008. And ever since then, I've been kind of transitioning to a place of more joy on stage, trying to share joy as opposed to be a crank, or be, you know, a shock value comic, which I kind of was into in the very early days. So it's definitely been a transformation, and I wouldn't go as far to say that I'm healing people. I mean, I think that's a lofty kind of goal to shoot for as a comedian, for sure, and laughter, they say, is the best medicine. But I definitely believe in trying to share joy, and I believe that's helpful for people. But I think it would be presumptive of me to say that I definitely do that, like night in and night out, because, you know, sometimes I may come up a little short on that.
Well, I'm sure you think that. How did you, because to me, like, even thinking I want to be a comedian would be scary to me. Like, how did you come to that realization, like, this is what I want to do?
No, it's interesting to me because, like, the more I'm researching all this esoteric knowledge, I'm reading Rudolf Steiner right now, How to Know Higher Worlds, and this book is really blowing my mind. But, and I think it's, like, kind of tapping me into being a little more intuitive about things in my own life now, and also from my past. It's weird. It's like retroactive intuitiveness. I don't know if that makes any sense,
mm-hmm.
How you can be intuitive about something that's already happened. I mean, it reminds me of, like, I had this friend in college who, he watched one of the Mission Impossible movies with Tom Cruise, and he'd already seen it, and then he watched it with me at, like, on campus at my apartment or whatever. And then after he watched it, he said, you know, it's really predictable the second time you watch it. I was like, yeah, but he was being dead serious. And I'm like, yeah, because you've seen it. Like, how is it not predictable? Yeah, but I feel like, you know, I feel like some of my, when I look back, knowing how certain things have happened, I'm like, oh, yeah, it's very predictable now that I know what's already happened. But it's, you know, when I was a kid, I was so connected to adults for some reason, more so than children. When adults laughed, I was like, how do I make that happen? Because I realized now that I was kind of intuitive enough as a little kid to understand that laughter was the surefire way to win or to acquire a bond with someone, especially in an adult. If you made an adult laugh, they loved you. And I remember picking, I, you know, obviously didn't have the words as a kid to understand that, But I just remember thinking as a kid, like, if I can make adults laugh, I'm in. I'm in the group, right? And so then I kind of knew from that, from just watching, from them watching, you know, David Letterman or Johnny Carson on TV late at night, or then, you know, then later Jay Leno, I'd just be a kid watching with some adults at like a family get together, because they got together every weekend for something, to play cards and stuff. So, and whoever wasn't playing cards was watching late night and laughing at the comedian. So I was like, this is how you do it. And so then that kind of like, boom, that transitioned me in to understanding what it was and wanting to do it.
Wow. What's that quote? Laughter is the shortest distance between two people, or something like that.
Yeah, I believe that is it.
That's so cool. So when did you first do stand-up comedy? Were you in college?
Yeah, I guess. It's kind of it's hard to really nail down, but I used to, when I went to Bowling Green State University in Northern Ohio, right out of high school, and I worked at this great little Irish pub called Trotter's Tavern. It's still there, I believe. And I cooked. I was a cook there because it was an easy way to eat, because I was real broke. So, like, you know, I tried to work as much as possible, because that meant I got to, like, eat that day and eat pretty well, you know. And so they would let me, if I finished cooking in time, or if there wasn't a lot of food orders coming in, they'd let me drag an amp out into the front of the bar. And I'd plug in my greasy T-shirt and jeans. And I would tell jokes to the people as they were eating the food I just cooked them. And they thought it was great. I mean, looking back, the comedy was awful. And I'm surprised the people ever came back to the restaurant after having been subjected to that. But so that's where it kind of started for me. And then probably the first like gig I ever had was I was at a party with friends in college. A bunch of high school friends over the summer, and they decided that I should perform stand-up comedy, because I think I told them I'd done it once or twice at this restaurant. And so they moved all of the couches and set up like a little stage for me in the basement of this party, and then I was forced to perform, even though I didn't want to. And I ended up doing, I don't know, I think like 20 minutes or something. And so I was probably 21 years old when that happened. And then I was 21 the first time, and then after that I went to my first ever open mic night at a comedy club. And then I think I did a handful of open mics between 21 and maybe 22, and then that's when the religious, like, the relapse crisis kind of thing, like, where I thought the world was ending, selfish because I wanted to be a comedian, happened. And so that lasted about 2.5, almost 3 years, and then 25 is when I got back into it.
That first year, before the crisis, were you still thinking about going into the priesthood, and at the same time doing those first comedy things? Was that still a part of your psyche at that point?
Yeah, it was definitely like intertwined in a way, because I remember I do remember researching Christian comedians and seeing if it was even possible to be a Christian comedian. And I was like, well, I want to do this, but I still want to be, I don't want to be a priest maybe, but how can I do Christian comedy? And then that didn't really jive with me. I think I found one person on, this was like, early 2001 or something, or 99, 2000. So it was, the internet wasn't really exploded yet the way it is now, where you can find everything, but there was only one person, and I don't know if he was a comedian as much as he was just kind of like a comedic Christian speaker. And I wish I could remember his name, but so I looked into that, if that was possible. But then I think deep down I knew that these were just topical solutions I was searching for, and like I wasn't really curing the cause of what was really happening with me. Because I think deep inside I knew I had especially back then, there was a real darkness that I wasn't addressing. It wasn't until years later that I kind of, understood that you just got to face it and really evaluate it and move on from there. And I think opening my mind to the idea that the universe had a lot of things happening in it that I needed to explore, that weren't evil, out of necessity of being exclusive from Catholicism. That's what really kind of transitioned me into like the lightness, and then removing the darkness and guilt and fear and all that kind of stuff that it was that I was based on. It was like the Fox News of, at least the way I interpreted the religion system. It was like, be afraid, behave because you're afraid, as opposed to, no, you should do this out of kindness and out of love because this is what makes everything better and more enjoyable. So, it's a difference between, to me, like trying to do, research this esoteric knowledge and understand truth and light and, become more one with the universe is kind of like doing volunteer work as opposed to being sentenced to do community service by the court, which is kind of like that real strict religious kind of indoctrination. It's like, no, you have to do this, as opposed to, hey, this will make, you do it and you figure out, oh, I really enjoy doing this. This is great.
Cool. I want to ask you, I always say that my gateway drug into spirituality were crystals. So I want to ask you what your gateway drug aspect of this was. But first, we need to take a quick break and just mention our sponsor. As you all know, we are sponsored by Audible, and we are very grateful to be sponsored by them. If you go to audibletrial.com/psychicteachers, you'll get a free one-month trial. This week, I'm recommending, it's a really fun 4-minute clip of Ryan Singer, a joke that Ryan has done. It's called United Snacks of America, and you can find that on Audible, so check that out. I also want to recommend a book that Ryan has recommended on his website that I really want to read. It's called The Lucifer Effect by Philip Zimbardo. Am I saying that right?
Yes.
That sounds really good.
Yeah, it is the guy who, he was the psychologist who was in charge of the infamous Stanford prison experiment many years ago. It's very famous. It's about how people put into certain systems will, regardless of who they are, will eventually start reacting a certain way, even if they're not like necessarily bad people. So it's all about how like the system has effects on the things that are inside of it and how we have to be more aware of like the actual system that we're inside of, as opposed to trying to blame one individual person as being evil. It's more about what is causing this person to act in evil ways.
Wow. That's really cool. All right. So check it out, guys. audibletrial.com/psychicteachers. And we appreciate your support. Okay, so Ryan, what would you consider was your hook into this whole world of esoteric studies? Did it start with psychic abilities or near-death experiences or crystals yourself, or what was the hook for you?
Well, I think there was a lot of mini hooks, and then one big one came in. I think there was a lot of, like, I was nibbling on a lot of bobbers, and then one day a big fishnet came in and just scooped me out of the water. I think the world of stand-up comedy lends itself to the misfits of society, kind of all different kinds of misfits kind of funnel into this world where they don't feel like they have a place necessarily. And so you meet all kinds of different people. And then I'd met a friend of mine who believed he was abducted by aliens and had an implant inside of him. And I had no reason not to believe him. And he showed me a scar on his shoulder that was indicative of the story he told me. When he was touched by an alien, kind of like a lizard alien of some kind, like burned his skin. And at the time, and I understand, if there's one thing I have awareness about in my life, it's how weird I can sound to certain people. This was at the same time I thought that I had a lizard living in my brain. I had this weird sensation at the back lower part of my head where like your skull meets like your neck.
Mm-hmm.
I always felt like something was trying to, like, it was this weird sensation I couldn't describe other than saying it was like a lizard.
Rising.
Reptilian brain.
It felt like it was trying to claw out, tried to escape.
I hear
ya. So I told my friend that. And so I told him that story, and then he told me about how he was abducted, and then I started trying to research about reptilians and all these other things, and the internet didn't have anything back then on this stuff, really. And so then I meet this young woman, and I tell her the same story, and then she confides in me how she can shapeshift or morph and she has no control over it, and it's kind of a curse. And it's like been this burden her entire life, and she's always been considered a freak.
Wait, like a werewolf? Like she shapeshifts into an animal?
Well, not into an animal, not in that tradition. Yeah, so it's like not necessarily like in the way of like a traditional Native American like shapeshifter or into a wolf or a bird or an eagle or something like that, but she would sometimes she would appear to be other people to people or to someone looking at her, she would appear to be someone else. If she looked at herself, she would not see that person. She would just still see herself. And then that was, I guess, the most common one for her. And then that's the first time it happened with us. She, not to be too graphic, but we were laying in bed one night because we'd started dating. And then I looked over at her and she was a different woman and I freaked out. And it only lasted for maybe a second, right? But it was enough to like totally make me feel like I'd lost my mind. And this was the first time where I thought to myself, oh, I might actually just be crazy. I've given up. I've abandoned all of my belief systems at this point, right? I have no anchor, nothing tethering me to the ground. I think there's a lizard in my brain. And now this woman who can shapeshift just appeared to be someone else. Like, what is real? And so it all kind of came crashing. And she, you know, eventually talked me down, which is, you know, in hindsight, it's like one of my most regrettable things. You know, like you never know how you're going to react in a situation until you're faced with it. Because before that, when she had confided in me these things, I told her how awesome and fascinating it was and that I wouldn't judge her. And I wasn't judging her, and I thought it was incredible that I thought she was almost superhuman. And then when it happens and I get to experience it, I freak out, you know, typical. So, which is why she was always so hesitant to tell anybody about it. And I was reinforcing that fear. So I was kind of upset with myself about that in hindsight. We never really spoke about it. And then shortly after that was the second time we experienced something together with her. It was, we were supposed to have a date and she canceled because she said it happened again. So I just immediately drove over to her apartment. This was when I was living in Los Angeles many years ago, and probably about 11 years ago. And I went over, and then she opened the door. She eventually let me in, and she said she was at work, and this woman walked by her desk and said, who was really pregnant, about ready to have her baby. And she just remembered thinking to herself how happy that woman looked, and she wished she could be happy like that. And then the woman just walked off. And she said about half an hour later, she realized she was no longer fitting into her clothing. She had, like, she started expanding. Like, she was becoming pregnant, almost instantly. And so she lifts up her sweatshirt when I'm in her apartment. We are right in the middle of her living room. And she shows me she looks 9 months pregnant. And I always tell people, like, as a kind of, like, to soften the mood a little bit. Like I grew up in Southern Ohio. All of my sisters were pregnant at like 18. So I'd been around, you know, pregnant women before. And, you know, I had a lot of experience with that. And she was no different than my sisters. Like she was like, you know, there was no baby kicking. We couldn't feel any kicking or, you know, there was no movement sensed inside, but she was definitely pregnant. But by the next morning she was totally back to normal. And, there was no mistaking it. I mean, she's kind of a tiny woman, you know, maybe like 5'5", 100 pounds, 110 pounds soaking wet. And it looked like she had swallowed a beach ball.
Wow.
So that was amazing. And then I actually reacted in a, you know, in an excited, you know, not like, oh my God, a supportive way is a better way to say it. And then from then on out, it's been the Wild West for me in what I'm willing to believe, because no matter how crazy someone sounds when they're telling me maybe or sharing their story with me, I have to remember, oh, if I was telling them that I used to date a girl who could shapeshift, what would they say? Like, they're like, oh, this guy is crazy. And there's people who think I'm crazy, and I'm aware of that. But I guess, you know, when we come out of the attic, so to speak, about, you know, believing or being willing to believe in all these weird things or things that are weird to other people. I guess that's the risk we take. And, you know, it's a small price to pay to, be open to the magic of the world. That's for sure.
Well said. And it's better than being a sheep, you know, and just following along with what everyone else believes.
Yeah, for sure. And I'll tell you, I had no idea that it would lead me on this journey, because it took, you know, that was, you know, over 10 years ago, and, you know, maybe 11 years ago now. And, you know, it wasn't until I started Me and Paranormal You that I really kind of took public ownership of it all. I mean, everyone who knew me, and I've even told the stories on stage before, but not very often. But everyone who knew me knows about it. But, you know, people in the public generally didn't. And it wasn't until I started that, you know, the public ownership took place. And then everything's just been kind of, you know, a real fun ride ever since, trying to just gather information along the way and learning about magic and, you know, crystals. I love crystals. I mean, I'm really into the idea of, you know, collecting and using and, you know, using them more as like reminders for myself too. Like, there's a lot of crystals I always try to use when I'm performing. Like, carnelian's probably my favorite. I got this big carnelian necklace that I like to wear while I'm on stage for performance.
I love carnelian.
Yeah, we both do.
Yeah, so it's like, it's one of my favorites for sure. And so I really love it. And I'll tell you, you know, I've been talking about the crystals too in my act it's not on any of my albums or anything at this point, but it will be on my next one, I'm sure. And more people are responding to that, I've noticed, over the course of the last year and a half since I've started talking about it. It seems like more slightly larger and larger groups of the audiences are in on it, and they know. And so many people have come up to me after shows and talked to me about whether it's about how they're a Wiccan or how they're really into crystals, or, you know, or whether it's just the you know, how they're yoga teachers and they're trying to access higher worlds through meditation and things like this, or higher knowledge or astral projection. And it's just, like, really cool. It's really, really cool.
You know, it is. And more people are waking up. And that's why I think it's important for you to have the courage to talk about that on stage. Because when they see someone, you know, who's quote-unquote normal, you know, like you or me or Deb, people think, okay, if they can do it, I can do it too. I wanted to mention real quick, so your latest comedy album is Immortal for Now. And I just love that title.
Oh, thanks.
Immortal for Now. And if you guys like that title too, you can. Ryan sells it in T-shirts on his site. I seriously have to get a T-shirt. How'd you come up with that title?
While we're talking, I want to put all of Ryan's contact information in the chat room, and then we'll say it out loud so everybody who's listening can.
We'll link it up on Facebook too.
We sure will.
Oh, okay, cool.
Absolutely. But Ryan, we have a question in the chat room for you. Somebody says, I'm curious if you talk about the stories that you're telling us tonight in your show, and if you do, and if you put a funny spin on it, or how are those worlds coming together for you, I think is a question the listener is asking.
Okay. I have in the past, more than a handful of times, I've talked about the story. Years ago, it was 5 years ago, me and two friends of mine, very funny comedians, Tom Simmons and Billy Wayne Davis, we did a show called Kooks. It was a live show that we kind of wrote in the hotel room. And we performed at this place called the Laughing Skull Lounge in Atlanta, Georgia, a really small, intimate comedy club. And we talked about, it was a conspiracy comedy show, and we talked about everything. And telling the story about the lizard in my brain and the shapeshifter was an integral part of that show for us. And it was interesting, I mean, to try to find a way to translate something that might be so out of the ordinary scope of consideration for most people, or what they consider to be possible, is a real challenge. And I've been working on it and trying, certainly here and there. I pick my spots when I'm working on it, but I have an idea for, I'm planning on doing a one-man show soon, probably sometime next year, and I'm kind of playing with titles about it, but it'll definitely be worked in there, like something from Catholic to crystals or something like that. But there's definitely a way. I think humor is the best way to convey any belief. To me, that's my personal opinion. Like, because if you don't have a sense of humor about what you believe, I think you become very overbearing in how you communicate to people. And I try not to be that person who I think we've all known those people who have really good information, but their delivery system is off because whether it's, and I get it, some of these things are very important and, you know, could even be considered life or death, but no one wants to be told what to do about anything ever. And it's been that way since we were children. And we don't want to be told how to vote. We don't want to be told how to feel about guns. We don't want to be told what God to believe in. We don't even want to be told what to eat for dinner, or we don't want to be told what socks to wear. I mean, it goes down to the tiniest, or how we should wear our hair. And so it's like, if you can prove that you understand, you know, that it's, I don't know. It's this is the struggle with it. It's finding that perfect way to mass translate it, because language to me is such a rudimentary toolbox. I mean, I feel like we're still learning how to use our words as a creature, let alone, you know, as, you know, the specialization of different languages inside of that. But so to really communicate, that's what I think is so beautiful about esoteric knowledge. And every, like, when you find something that someone has written in a way that it just clicks, it's like a new nodule in your brain pops out and you're like, oh, this is truth. I get it. It's like there's something really remarkable about being able to communicate in a way that's so precisely that a lot of people get it. So I certainly am trying, but as of right now, it's not as mainstream as I'd like it to be. So it's still kind of a work in progress.
Well, I think that you're, I don't know if you call it a slogan, but you're, the thing that you always say on Me and Paranormal You is it's more fun to believe. And I think that sums up your whole philosophy of combining those, you know, those two worlds. I wanted to ask you another question, Ryan. So Deb and I, you know, we're very good friends, but we're very different. You know, I'm the Catholic girl and she's the pagan girl. And I believe in, you know, a lot of the negative side of this work, you know, like I definitely believe that there's the D word and all of those things, and Deb doesn't like to go there. So I would just love your go ahead, Deb. What?
I'm just not going there. That's all I want to say.
Yeah, she's won't go there. Like I saw on your recommended reading list that you had put Rosemary Ellen Guiley's book, the Vengeful Djinn. It's like one of my favorite books. Deb was like, don't even say that title. So I would just love to know, like, where do you stand with the scary stuff and the airy fairy stuff? Do you believe?
Oh man, I actually, right before we started talking, I went and found my Circle of Solomon pendant that I bought off eBay or Etsy. I had to buy it while I was reading that book because I got frightened. As like a protection pendant. And I don't know. I do know that if, you know, it's interesting because, like, I'm the furthest thing you could be from a scientist and all this other kind of stuff, but I do believe in the positive and the negative and, like, the yin and the yang and the balance. And so I feel while they might not be, you know, there might not be personal vendettas that these negative entities or evil things are trying to necessarily do, there is that force happening, and it is there. And, you know, if you talk to there's many people who are willing to share their stories about, and their stories sound horrific, and it's almost like you don't want to believe them because it's like, well, how could this be possible? But I do believe that, you know, there, with anything else, you can't be, I don't think you can be nonchalant and reckless about it. There's a big difference between having a sense of humor about something and mocking something. And I think that's when you kind of can get into some danger. I know I'm working on a web series right now that deals with a lot of this stuff, and it could, you know, I'm trying to be very careful in the way I prepare it before I shoot it, that it's not, that people aren't trying to come after me because of it. That sounds a little more nefarious than it actually is, but I don't want, you know, people to be like, because it deals with, like, you know, the occult and, you know, black magic. So, but I don't want, you know, a bunch of black magicians to be like, oh, I need to, we need to teach this guy a lesson. Like, I'm not interested in that. But I do believe there's people out there who are taking advantage of people in what they're willing to believe in. And I think that's, I don't think it's unacceptable necessarily. I mean, anyone can do what they want, but I do think that it's unfortunate that there's people, whenever there's a chance for someone to believe in something, there's someone close by trying to make a dollar off of them.
Yeah.
And sometimes those dollars go to a good cause, sustaining someone's work and when they're doing good work. But unfortunately, and it's a perfect example of like what we're talking about, how there's light and there's dark, or there's negative and positive. Just like that, sometimes some of those dollars go to the good side, sometimes some of those dollars go to the bad side. Someone taking advantage or a charlatan of some kind. So I definitely believe it's not to be trifled with to the degree of, disrespecting something or outwardly mocking something or even being totally dismissive of it. Because it also, what I find is depending on who you talk to, there's all these different rules for what you shouldn't do. And it's tough to keep track. Like, I have a friend of mine who's like, you should not keep a Ouija board in the house. Then I have another friend who's like, no, a Ouija board is fine to keep in the house as long as if you use it, you close it afterwards. Not close the box, but, you know, like ceremonially close it. And then I'm like, well, I'll just keep it in my car. Can I do that? And they're like, well, you're in your car. You know, maybe I'm like, so it's like, oh, should I bury it in my backyard and then dig it up when I want to use it? So it's like there's a lot of things, and I haven't used it yet. But I can't get the thing open, the planchet. I can't get it open to put the battery in it. But I don't have a screwdriver small enough. Like, I mean, how is it that I believe I can talk to or contact spirits, but I haven't been able to find a tiny enough screwdriver. It's easier to find a spirit than it is a tiny screwdriver, apparently.
That's so funny.
So I do believe, you know, there's just like anything else. If you're really careless and reckless with it, you'll end up hurting yourself, maybe.
Definitely always say it goes back to intention.
It does, and I want to clarify Samantha's description of what I say and do. it is not that I deny the existence of the dark side, as we will just call that general place. I very much know it exists. I very much am aware of it being there, and I too have read and heard some horrific stories that folks have lived through with some of that darkness, so I do acknowledge it. But I also know that I don't want it in my energy field. I be kind of Pollyanna-ish, I suppose, about it, where if I don't allow it into my psyche, then it isn't real in my reality. And that may be wrong, but that philosophy has stood me in good stead.
Yeah, I mean, it's your party. You can invite who you want, right?
That's right.
And it's your house.
Yeah, right. I don't want those folks in my house. That's right. Exactly.
And I don't blame you. It's interesting because I this has never happened to me before. It's so weird. It didn't happen to me specifically, but I was witnessing it. I was there when it was happening. I was at a comedy show very recently here in Los Angeles, and it was called a tarot comedy show where they you go up and you get a mini reading real quick from this woman, Angie, who's great and could give you like this really quick little quick vibe. You could either pull a card or she'll give you a really quick reading and then you do your set. Well, this young comedian it's really cool. And there's a woman, Karen Rontowski, who I've had a few times on my show. She's been doing her own tarot comedy show for years out here in Los Angeles. And it's really fun. But this one young comedian was on stage before me, and then he was detailing an encounter he had with a woman who was he had just met the night before, who was Wiccan, and he's Muslim, and he had never met a Wiccan before. And then she was saying, "Oh, we experience the exact same things. You know, it's very controversial to be a Muslim." And he's like, "Well, you know, it's not exactly the same. There's, you know, over a million of us." But so he was just kind of detailing the difference between Wiccan and Muslim. A woman in the audience apparently she piped up and started like heckling, if you want to call it, but heckling, saying she was a witch and she was putting a spell on him, like actively in that moment. I'm putting a spell on you, she said. And everybody in the audience was just kind of like, what's going on? And he was on stage like, okay, you're kidding, right? And she's like, no, I've already started. And he's like, well, what do you, and then you could see he got very, very nervous. And I was just in the back, like, trying to generate an energy bubble to send to them or something. I've never been in a situation where I've even tried to do that before. I mean, I've contacted some friends before, and we've kind of got this little network when we try to send some protection or good vibes to people every once in a while, and it seems to work. But and I was just like, oh my gosh, what's happening? And then she just kept saying it and kept saying it. And then afterwards, he walks off stage and he's very rattled. And I was like, well, to make him feel better. I was like, my intuition tells me that if she was a real witch, she wouldn't be telling you that she was putting a spell on you right now. She would just be doing it. So I wouldn't worry too bad, but I'll call some friends later and we'll try to, I'll just, you know, give them your name and stuff and try to have them send some good vibes your way. But, and after the show, apparently an hour or so later, she walked up and she's like, I was just kidding about that. It's like, to me, that seems like you're really messing with people in a way that is kind of irresponsible.
No,
to do that
no real witch
like
would have ever done that.
Yeah, that was my intuition was telling me that, yeah. Like, she's trying to be funny and thinks it's cool. And if there was a real witch in that audience watching her do that, then, oh gosh, she's probably not too happy about how she's representing her or him.
Right, no real witch would have done that. And if she claimed to have also been a Wiccan witch, then the philosophy of Wicca is harm none. Two simple words.
Yeah, so, yeah, that'll be, I'll have to, you know what, that reminds me, I should reach out to him after we're finished chatting and just remind him that I've got it on pretty good authority that, you know.
Sure, that
all.
He's okay.
Let him know he's all right.
Right, before we're
just about 4 minutes before the end of the show, and I just talk about two or three things I want to be sure we do. One is to give folks your contact information, and I want you to talk about your next gig at AlienCon. So it's RyanSingerComedy.com, and that's Ryan with a Y, R-Y-A-N-S-I-N-G-E-R, comedy.com, and me and ParanormalU.com. And is there any other way you want us to let folks know how to find you?
I love Instagram. So if anybody out there is on Instagram, I love like following other people's lives and photos and sharing mine. It's Rising, R-Y-S-I-N-G. It's like the first half of both my names. So it's just Rising.
Okay.
It's the same on Twitter.
That's cool.
But Instagram, I love Instagram a lot. So if anybody wants to kind of follow, I love posting pictures of in the mountains when I go hike. I try to hike almost every day. I'm home in L.A. And then also pictures of, interesting stuff that I find. Or, maybe what I'm doing, like, in the paranormal side of things.
Cool. Okay.
That's awesome. All right. Tell us about AlienCon.
Well, AlienCon, apparently it's the first year, I think History Channel and like Sci-Fi and all those people are kind of behind it. And so a lot of actors who have been in like Battlestar Galactica and things like that, television shows like that. And then also a lot of, prominent, quote unquote, famous speakers in the field of, the paranormal or UFOs and things like that. Like George Norrie will be there, the host of Coast to Coast AM. And also a lot of the Ancient Aliens people will be there. So I'm hoping – I've never met any of them. So I'm hoping to, lock some of them in and get them on the microphones. It's a three-day event where they're just kind of, celebrating everything, extraordinary and, UFO and alien related. So there's going to be a lot of talks and workshops and then also a lot of meet and greets with actors from some of people's favorite television shows that dealt with space and the paranormal.
That's so cool. And for those of you who are new to Ryan Singer's work, he does his podcast twice a week as opposed to our once a week. So that's a lot of output
that you're
doing.
Ryan Singer, I just have to tell you, here's to you.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I tell you what, when I decided to start doing the 30 or bonus ones where I just kind of research a subject, I didn't realize how much work I was giving myself. And, oh, man. Every week I got, like, a high school term paper due.
It's a lot of work, but it's so well-researched. I mean, I learn a lot listening to your podcast. I love it. I hope other people go and check it out.
I hope so, too.
Well, I'm glad. I always worry that they're not deep enough, but I'm glad that people are enjoying them.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, thank you
I've been
for joining
listened.
Us. Go ahead, Deb.
And I've enjoyed everything I've listened to.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate it, and I've been listening to some episodes that you two do, and they're great. And my friend Peggy, I'm gonna have to introduce you to her at some point. I'm hopefully interviewing her soon too, but she's a huge fan of yours, and
oh,
you know, for
so
good
cool.
reason. You two do great work, so thanks for. I'm really thrilled that you asked me to be on.
Thank you
oh,
so
we,
much,
thank
Ryan.
You.
Everybody, check out Ryan Singer, meandparanormalyou.com. And Deb, do you want to close us out?
I do. Ryan, again, thank you so very much. Everyone have a great week and be the light. Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Good night.